Hello, everyone. I'm happy to see you. Happy to be here. Another Thursday night. Earlier today, I had an appointment at the mairie, at the town hall, to renew my passport and my carte d'identité, my identity card, my French identity card. And I made this appointment 2 months ago. And there's all kinds of papers that you have to fill in and register them online and take pictures, buy special stamps because you have to pay for the passport and all this stuff. So I did it all and I organized my day so that I could go this afternoon. And I went there and I was 10 minutes early and the lady, you know, I go up to the counter and the lady said, oh, okay, well, she said something really fast. Sometimes people, when they speak French, it's too fast for me. And it was mumbled kind of behind the counter. And I said, what? I didn't understand. She said, oh, well, I have to take your name and your number and we'll call you next week and give you an appointment for next week. I said, but I have an appointment now. And earlier in the day, I had called to be sure that I had the appointment at that time because I couldn't find the paper saying what time it was. And the lady on the phone confirmed it. So then 3 hours later, I'm there and she's telling me she has to take my name and number. And I said, why? I don't understand. And she said, because we have a computer update, mise à jour of our system that is just started 10 minutes ago. And so we can't process any of the applications. I said, what? You know, she said, it doesn't depend on us. It's the préfecture. It's like the regional authorities who normally should do it at the end of the day and they started it now. You can't do anything. I'll take your name and number and we'll call you next week and give you an appointment. And I was, of course, very upset. And I said, you know, imagine if I had taken this time off work to come here and have this appointment. And I made this appointment 2 months ago. And she said, I can only take your name and number. I can't do anything else. So I had to give my name and number and go away. I was very upset, very annoyed. And, you know, I arranged my day around this and, you know, I was thinking of people who work and who would have taken time off work. Maybe had somebody take care of their kids because you have to be present. All I had to do was give her the papers. I mean, there was nothing, but they make you be there. The American passport, I put it in an envelope, mailed it off to the embassy, and 2 weeks later, they mailed me the passport. But the French authorities don't work that way, so you have to be there. So I was very upset. And as I was walking home, it's not very far from my house, I was walking home, and I was thinking, so what, you know, why am I so upset? Of course, I know it's part of I have what's called a Vajra temperament, which is perfectionist. And if something is, I can very quickly judge something as being stupid. incompetent. I've worked a lot on this tendency I have, but and it tends to tends to be very arrogant. It leads to arrogance, self-righteousness. I know better. These people are dumb. They don't know how to do it. They could do this differently. She could have just made an appointment for me right then and there. I asked. She couldn't do that. This is so inefficient. All this stuff. So my Vajra tendency was flaming. And part of the Vajra thing is control. So this was something I couldn't control. And which, you know, I took as a personal insult to my life that I should spend all this time, because it takes, you know, a lot of effort to do all this paperwork and everything. And so I looked at it through this Vajra viewpoint and saw that basically what was going on was that things changed. And that part of me didn't want the change. Wanted it to be a certain way. At that time, I wanted to drop off my documents, have my appointment, go home, I wanted to go for a walk. I wanted to go for a long walk. And get my passport, probably, and I don't know how long it takes to get the passport, but whatever. But it all changed. Like that. Completely unexpected. Just like that. And when I realized that it was the change that I was resisting, it became much easier. And I remembered that something that I heard Suzuki Roshi say, or I remember hearing that he said this, that the only teaching of the Buddha was everything changes. And if you got that, if you truly experience that and see the implications of that, life is different. He also said, the important thing is remembering the most important thing. The most important thing is everything changes. I mean, that's a way of saying it. But the most important thing is to remember the most important thing. So in that moment when my Vajra was flaming and I was really angry, I was forgetting the most important thing. And everything changes. So what does that mean for us? Well, for me today, it meant, okay, that's how it is. I came home and I told my husband about it, and you know, he, like, of course, he's French, and so he's like, oh yeah, welcome to France, that's French administration, and you know, all this thing about the French bureaucrats. And then he said, so I hope they'll call you. I hadn't thought of that. They won't call me. and I said, well, if they don't call me, believe me, I will call them. So that was taken care of. But I sat down, you know, and I thought, okay, so what does this mean now? Everything changes. And how does that, this too will change. So my my anger, my turmoil, my flaming Vajra temperament, that too will change. And it led me to well, to come back to, you know, the essential, the most important thing is to not lose touch with the most important thing, or to return to the most important thing. And because everything changes, which is the most important thing, we have to be, we can't hang on to things how we want it to be, to an idea, to a system, to a belief, to the way we want it to be or think it should be. And everything becomes so much easier when we do that, when we don't hang on to things. We have this, there's this koan that's, it takes place in a, I think it's called the Dragon Gate Temple, some sacred temple. And with famous teachers and legendary place. And one day, a monk is bitten by a snake at this temple, out in the gardens or in the landscape. And another monk is stunned by this. And he asks the teacher, how can this be? How is it that this monk could be bit by a snake here at the Dragon Gate Temple? It doesn't matter so much that it's called Dragon Gate, but. And the koan says, the teacher manifested the figure of the great man. Then the koan goes on, and later, I don't know how long after, another teacher somewhere else heard about this story and said, owing to, there's a teacher at that eastern mountain, and owing to him, this, the Dharma will not, has not died out or something. So this teacher manifests the figure of the great man. And we think, oh, what's he, what does that mean? The monk is asking, how could this monk get bitten by a snake at this great place, you know, where everything is perfect, everything is so, everyone is awakened. How can something bad happen here? How can this be possible? And the teacher's response is to manifest the figure of the great man. So when you're working on this koan, you have to look into this and say, okay, well, what does it mean to manifest the figure of the great man? As we know with our koan practice in general, the most important thing is the most important thing, which is to be one with whatever it is. The koans are pointing to realizing a realization of the oneness of life. The great man, you know, I suppose we could say it's the Buddha. What was the Buddha's teaching? Just like Suzuki, everything changes. If we take that a step further, everything changes and our response is what's the important thing. So how do we respond to what changes? We can only respond true response, let's say, or the response from a position of oneness is to be one with it, to be one with the circumstances, to be one with the situation. So I go, she tells me she can't take my papers, I can't have my appointment. I give her my name and my phone number and I go away. I just respond. When I resist that, I'm really upset, angry, and suffer. But if I don't resist it, and afterthought, I realize that the guy ahead of me didn't resist it at all. He was kind of standing there joking with her and gave her his name and number and walked away. I didn't know what he was doing. But once I had been there, I realized it. So we cause ourselves suffering when we resist what changes. The way of Zen is to be it, be whatever is, to be one with the circumstances, with the ingredients that you have, like Bernie Glassman would say. In this moment, what's the situation? What are your ingredients? In this room where you are, this is your throne of enlightenment, right where you are. That will change. It always changes. So you will have different ingredients in another moment. And yet, the only thing we can ever do, and the only thing we ever have to do, is respond with the ingredients that we have, which we don't actually have, but we are. So you are the teaching. You are the container. You are the vehicle. That's the most important thing. You don't have to be somewhere else. You don't have to be someone else. You don't have to have anything else. It's all perfect right where you are. I learned a lot by spending so much time with my teacher and helping her basically create a sangha, create a center, and develop her teaching. You know, when I started sitting with her, there was only one other student in Paris, and not very many anywhere else. And when I met her, she was looking around for a place to start a Zen center. She had only, not even a year before, received transmission and had been living with her teacher, and then had been living in Poland for a year and a half, leading retreats, and had come back to France and was going to start a center. But she had this idea about it. And so she was looking in the countryside. She looked in Burgundy, in Provence, Normandy, visited places. She wanted to buy an old chateau, create a big center where lots of people would come and live, monks. And she looked at various places. And then I think last week I told the story about doing our first retreat in the house at Donna, that is now Donna. So we were sitting there once a week, and then suddenly my husband's family decided to sell that house. And so my husband, Alain, knew, of course, that Roshi was looking for a place. Sensei at the time was looking for a place. He told her, you know, this place is for sale. Are you interested? And she wasn't really, because it wasn't what she was looking for. It was way too small. It wasn't in the country. And it wasn't what she was looking for. But it just so happened that her teacher, who's in Paris at the moment, at that time, Genpo Roshi, and she told him about it. And he said, oh, let me see the house, you know. So they went and looked at it. I think we even sat there one night with him. And he said, and they looked around, and as they left, she said, so what do you think? And he said, well, I can't believe you're even looking for something else. Seems perfect. He explained then, because, and she realized this too, because of the community that was around her. So there were only a few of us in Paris. And the other people lived in various countries. Nobody was a monk. Everyone had jobs, families. And suddenly it became clear that, yeah, in the circumstances of her sangha, that was the place to do it. Not someplace out in the country, because nobody would have been able to come and do it, to move to the countryside. Everybody had kids and jobs and lives. At that moment, none of us were going to become monks, you know. So basically, I tell this story because she responded to her circumstances. She looked at her ingredients and said, okay, this is what we'll do. Almost 30 years later, it's still thriving with the same kind of community. She has no monks. She has a few people who live there. No children. Not like when I lived there. But people still come into retreats and people live there. People come and practice daily. It was her response. My response for my sangha is completely different because I don't have the same sangha. I don't have the same situation, the same ingredients. We all respond according to our ingredients. And if we try to fit some idea, fit people into our idea, it doesn't work. Nobody here is probably a football fan like me. But there's an interesting situation, which is, you know, there's this famous football team, Barcelona, right? And for 20 years, they've been like the most amazing football team. Now in the past, started maybe 3 years ago, especially now this year, they're not good. And what has happened is that there was a system of the way this team played, which developed as a result of the players that were there. But now it's as if they keep trying to play that same system, but they don't have the players that fit in it anymore. So it doesn't work. The successful football team now, mostly, which is Liverpool, let's just take that as an example, is the opposite. The coach has adapted his system to fit the players that he has. So he plays to the strengths, he uses a system that uses the strengths of his players, instead of trying to fit those players into a set system. This is a completely Zen lesson for me. This is a Bernie Glassman teaching. So, you know, Are you going to make a, pasta, you know, with an Italian sauce using couscous and curry? No. And you're not going to make a curry with Italian seasoning. If you have curry, well, then you make a curry. If you have Italian seasoning, well, you make an Italian dish. This is kind of really basic, but it's that idea. You use what you have. And you respond to the situation according to what there is. So I come back to my situation this afternoon. The situation was, I did everything I was to do. I filled in all my papers, I did my pictures, I paid for my stamps, I verified the appointment, I went on time. It didn't happen. So I did what I could, I gave her my name and number, and left. I couldn't force her into my system of how it should be. Well, I thought it should be. So, you know, how do you manifest the figure of the great man? Man not being, I'm not using this in like you have to be a man as opposed to a woman. You know, if we think the figure of the great man is the Buddha. So how do you manifest it right now? Because you're not working on the koan, I'm not going to ask you to manifest it as it applies to the koan, but, you know. What system are you attached to and you're trying to fit your life into it? Instead of saying, this is who I am, this is where I am, this is what I can do. Bernie Glassman, again, famously, in his community, there were a lot of homeless people, unemployed people, people with AIDS, single mothers. He responded to the needs of that community. Geno Roshi responded to the needs of her community. I had two kids, a full-time job. She said, okay, you can live here. I'm sure that was not at all what she thought a Zen center should look like. Fortunately, she was creative. She had realized what it meant to manifest the teaching of the great man and knew that that was a response to the situation. I'm not saying she created that house for me. She created that house for the people who were around her, and I was not the only one. How do you manifest the teachings of the great man, the figure of the great man? Knowing that you are the Dharma, you are the container, you are the vehicle. Everything changes. So you're not who you think you are. I wish I could find another non-sporting example, because I don't really have a sangha of sports fans, so my sports metaphors only go so far. But there are some sports fans. If Oscar was here, I could talk to him about this football thing. Seu was a sports fan, that's true. Football fan, yeah. If Oscar was here, I could tell him the names of the coaches and the teams, and he would know exactly what I've been talking about. Or if it was basketball, I could talk to Freddie about it. So, rugby, Joa. So, okay. Anyone have anything to say, or questions, or something else unrelated? Freddie, yeah.
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to add that Duke Ellington did the same thing. He had an orchestra with a lot of musicians, and his composition and the way he orchestrated things was very particular about each musician he had. That's why his music was so interesting, because he did with the musician he had. He did the same thing.
Wow, great. Thank you, Freddie. Perfect. Yeah. Absolutely. Krisha.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. Amy, loved your talks. A lot of things to say, but not going to say all of them. I have a question. When you say you resist it, you notice it, and you didn't want the change, I got stuck, or there's something I'm not getting. Was it that you noticed that it was your Vajra turmoil sense that came in, and you got it, but you didn't want to let go of that resistance, or is just things change and I have to go with it? Although to me, it's okay, but it's okay to try to ask for the person there, if she can make the appointment right now, why that she, you can try to have it the right way, or the way you think it's better, and see what happens. Nothing wrong with that. But where I get confused was in the change part. Did you notice and you didn't want to let go, or you noticed and you notice it's much easygoing?
What do you mean?
Yeah, my English is not good here.
I cut off for a minute there. So you mean, at what point did I, no, say that again. Can you?
Okay. The change, everything changes. Mm-hmm. And you know it, of course. You've done a lot of work, but sometimes it still appears your turmoil.
Yes, because everything changes.
Yes. And did you want it not to let go of your turmoil?
Consciously, no.
Uh-huh.
I was caught by it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was caught by wanting it to be a certain way. I mean, this is like a perfect storm for me, administrative stuff, because I'm like the perfect student who does everything right. and had it all ready. You know, I had the whole dossier ready, perfect, you know, blue folder, everything, and pictures exactly like they're supposed to be, two different kinds in case one wasn't right, you know. And so, you know, I'm the perfect student. And then when they tell me no, it's like, what? This is the perfect storm for me. And so it's not that I didn't want to let go of it, but I got caught by it. And then when I realized it, well, then as soon as I realized it, well, then I could start, you know, letting go. I could, I mean, I knew that I was upset and that it was absurd to be, you know, I knew what was going on, but still I was doing it.
Okay. In solidarity, we have the same problem. In here in Portugal, I have to renew my identity card. And as I work in constructions, I thought, I'm not going to do this in Lisbon. This is going to be awful. And I called to, you know, a village away, and I did it on the same day. Talked with the lady. It was so good. So I don't know if that works in France, but in Portugal, it's possible. It was possible that day, but that happens a lot. The other thing I wanted to share, I don't know, that Cohen you talked, you know, that part of the Cohens that get too complicated, and I think I will never get into that. This is so, I don't even understand the English. How can I go through the Cohen and the stories behind it and whatever? But it reminded me of a story I read now I'm forgetting. And it's about a snake and Buddha. I don't know very well, but this is what you remind me. It was a snake that wanted to be no more a bad snake, you know, to kill people or whatever. But the other persons in the village still attack her and called her names. You are bad. But she never reacted. But she was feeling, you know, I'm doing everything right and people come to me anyway. She was supposedly, this story, it's what I remember, it's not very well counted. And she was, you know, complaining to Buddha. And he told me, it's okay, but I never told you for you to deny your own nature. And then the next time the other people went and say, you are bad, go away, we don't like you. She just did, you know. And that's what your koan reminded me when I get there in my koan process. I will see.
Yeah. You know, we have this idea that we should be something other than what we are. Yeah. And yet, who are you? You know?
Very, thank you.
Ready?
To me, it reminds me more the story. You will be more for you. You'll be more able to tell the story about the two monks and the lady. The two monks, one is carrying the lady, and the other one is, you know, those two monks. About letting go, about thinking what should be done. I think it's maybe you'll be more able to explain what I want to say.
You want to tell the story?
No, you tell the story.
Okay. All right. So there's two monks going on a pilgrimage somewhere, and they come to a stream, and they want to go across the river or something, and there's a woman there who also wants to cross, but there's no bridge, and she's carrying bundles or something, and she can't get across. So one of the monks takes her on his back and crosses over the river, brings her to the other side. Now, monks, they take a vow of celibacy, and they're not even supposed to touch a woman, right? So they go walking on, and one of the monks, the one who didn't carry her, is really silent, and in French we'd say il boude. He's really upset and not saying anything to his friend, and at one point he stops and he said, "I can't believe you picked that woman up. I can't believe you touched her and carried her across the river." And the one who did it said, "Yeah, I understand, but I put her down 2 hours ago and you're still carrying her." So, you know, he responded to the situation, he did what needed to be done, and then he moved on. And his friend was still stuck carrying her around with him. So I'm not sure, Freddie, exactly what you were pointing with this, that
it could be you and the man before you were casual and you were more concerned.
Right.
It could be that the same situation.
Right. Yeah, I was chewing and hanging on to my thing, whereas the guy in front of me, he just, okay, chatted with the person behind the counter and left. You know.
But it's always easy to point, but when it comes to us, because we all do that. It's
absolutely.
We all do that all the time. So
absolutely.
Okay, so it was just.
That's why the most important thing is to remember the most important thing. Because if we remember the most important thing, then we don't get caught like that so much. We have a better chance of not getting caught. So
it's only one image that this person, this administrative, sit there 7 hours and saying, "People, you leave your name and your number and come next week." 7 years, and for this person is. It's always the same. Also.
Yeah. And this person is not responsible for the fact that the computer was not, you know. Yeah. You know, it was like a few weeks ago we were talking about shift happens, right? Anyone remember that? Or was that during the retreat or something? No, what was it? Anyway, shift happens, yeah. Yeah. Everything changes. Because it's alive. If it wasn't alive, it wouldn't change. Ready.
They did experiment on people who meditate to see their reaction to pain compared to normal people, to people who don't meditate. And they remarked that people who meditate, they can feel the same pain than normal people. They have the same reaction, but they come back quickly to a normal position. So they feel the pain like everyone else, but they come back more quickly to a normal situation. So it's the remembrance of now. Everything happened, everything changed, but you come back to your breath, you come back to now.
David?
Well, and as Freddie is saying, if you don't get caught up in your pain or this situation, or you get caught up in it, but you see it, in fact, you've had a very interesting day and material for your Dharma talk. So it's kind of like if you just take what's there and don't spend the rest of the afternoon saying, what a bitch, I'm going to get her back, or you just wait and see what happens to yourself with it, then it's a whole different story. I mean, it's interesting. And for me, that's been the big difference. Now when crap happens to me, there's something interesting about it. It's interesting to see how you go through the mill of, I'm going to be angry. Oops, maybe I'm not going to be angry, and then things will change. What would you talk to us about if you hadn't been to the meeting?
I don't know. Because, generally I don't know what I will talk about on these evenings. When I was training with Roshi, she wouldn't let us prepare. So we didn't know we were giving a Dharma talk until like an hour before or something. And when I started giving weekly Dharma talks, after I had received transmission, I gave them on Friday nights at the Red Earth Center. I don't know if did you ever come there, Debbie? Yeah. And I worked on Fridays. And so I would go from work from the office, from the newspaper, the newsroom and all this business, to the Zen Center and have a half an hour Red Earth Center, sit for half an hour and then give a talk. So I had no time to prepare. And that was a great training for kind of what you're saying of just pay attention. The teaching is right there. Every moment is teaching. And so I would come and give the Dharma talks on Friday nights and with just whatever, like I still do now, just whatever is. Because that's this right now is the teaching. But you have to pay attention, like you say. You have to practice with it, with the moment, Make that your practice. Instead of if I come back to the football team metaphor, instead of having this set teaching that I was going to talk about and try to fit my life experience into that set teaching, Dharma talk, or just recite this teaching, read it off a piece of paper or something, that's not the teaching. teaching is, well, what is the ingredients right here and now? So that's what I talk about. It's the only thing I have to share. It's my experience. You know, if you want to read Suzuki Roshi's books, well, you don't need to have me talk about Suzuki Roshi. You know, of course, I've been listening to his archive of talks, so I have, he's very present for me, but you know, you can read his books or read Bernie's books or something. I'm not here to talk about that. I'm just here to talk about we're here and now, this, like you say, you know? That's the teaching. Yeah.
Amy, I'm not sure. When you finish your talk, you said something, but I'm not sure I have it right. But you said something like, "You are not what you think you are." Maybe you didn't say that exactly. I don't know. But what do you mean? Do you mean it's because everything is changing? So I'm already someone new. I'm already a new person. Is that what you mean?
In part, that's yes. But the implications of that are that you have never been who you think you are. So it's not even that, okay, by tomorrow you're someone else, but it's you've never been who you think you are. That everything is changing all the time, and the idea you have about yourself is just an idea. And as soon as you establish that idea, well, it's something else. All right. I did say that. I don't know if I said what you are, but I think I said who you are. You're not who you think you are. Which means that there's total freedom. I mean, that's such a liberation to not be who you think you are. It's wow. That means I can be anything. It's so limiting to think who you are, to think how things should be. I think we're about out of time here. Thank you for your participation. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. I remind you, we have a day of practice on Saturday. You don't have to join in all the periods, but if you want to join in any of them, you have to sign up so you can get the link. You can come just in the morning, you can come just for the talk, just the afternoon, whatever. And is there anything else? No? Is there anything else we needed to announce, Joa? I don't think so. Okay. Thank you.